G. Richard Bevan is a district judge serving in Idaho's 5th Judicial District with chambers in Twin Falls, Idaho. Judge Bevan was born and raised in Twin Falls, Idaho. He attended Ricks College, along with Sister Bevan, who attended Ricks College. He attended here for 1 year before serving a mission in the Finland Helsinki mission. After his mission, Judge Bevan attended Brigham Young University, where he received his undergraduate and law degrees, graduating in 1987 from BYU's J. Reuben Clark Law School. Upon graduating, Judge Bevan returned to his hometown, where he was admitted to the Idaho State Bar. He practiced and was involved in general litigation and insurance defense. In 1992, he was elected to the Twin Falls County prosecuting attorney. In 97, Judge Bevan returned to general legal practice in Twin Falls, engaging in a variety of legal matters for the next 6 years. Judge Bevan served as president of the 5th District Bar Association and has also served on several statewide law-related committees. While a practicing attorney, Judge Bevan became certified as a family and civil case mediator and successfully mediated over 200 cases to a conclusion before becoming a judge. Judge Bevan has been involved in the youth programs in the Twin Falls area for a number of years, past president and board member of the Magic Valley Family YMCA and the CARES Advisory Board, which is a commission designed to assist child victims of abuse or neglect in the Magic Valley. In addition to his legal pursuits, Judge Bevan is active in the church. He currently serves as bishop for the Twin Falls 19th Ward. Judge Bevan is married to Pam Ottersberg Bevan. They are the parents of 5 children, and currently they have 2 grandchildren. Again, we appreciate the opportunity of having Judge Bevan with us, and we'll now turn the time to him.
Thank you very much. Well, my dear brothers and sisters, it is an honor for me to be here on your campus today. I recognize, especially at the beginning of any new semester, that your time is valuable, and I hope and pray that what I share with you today will be worth the time you've given to be here and join with us. I would like to express my appreciation to those with whom my wife Pam and I have spent a few hours yesterday and this morning on your campus. BYU-Idaho is truly a wonderful place, and it is good for us to be able to experience it again after all these years and the multiple changes that have taken place. Approximately 33 years ago, I left my home and began my college education at Ricks College. I loved it here. I loved my classes, my instructors, my roommates, and yes, even that girl that I had my eye on, who is now my wife. I lived at the Alpine Chalet, the apartments with the A-frame over here on 2nd West, and 33 years ago, I can tell you, that was a happening place. Even if some of our recreation involved 8-track tapes and disco dancing. Pizza bombs were readily available at a place called the Sober Society, which has now been replaced by Crago's. I visited Crago's when my boys attended school here a few years ago, and I must say that the development of the Pizookie, in addition to the pizza bomb, is just one example of how things have progressed in Rexburg since I was here. I think back to my undergraduate days, and some of my best teachers and best learning experiences took place here in Rexburg. I remember well Professor Noel Zog, a chemistry teacher with whom I worked closely. He made chemistry fun, and I imagine he still does. I also remember well my feelings as I attended a missionary preparation class taught by F. Melvin Hammond, who later became a member of the First Quorum of the 70. And I recall what it was like to leave home and to spread my wings a little bit. But what a blessing it was to do so in the environment of this campus. And so I encourage each of you to enjoy and to appreciate these moments that you are now having. At this time in this place, with the right attitudes, I think that you will develop a very solid foundation for all the great things that are to come in your lives. Much has transpired since those early days in my freshman year. A mission to Finland, a marriage, undergraduate and graduate studies at BYU, and then law practice in Twin Falls, as you've heard. I became a judge in 2003. I've thought a lot about what I might share with you this afternoon that would be of some worth to you. I recognize that you are indeed unique students at a distinctive university. The mission statement of this institution establishes four goals for your education, and one of those goals is to prepare students for lifelong learning and for their roles as citizens and parents. My hope is that my remarks will help encourage your becoming good citizens and parents by giving you the perspectives of a trial judge. I speak today personally, and my remarks are my own. They are those simply of me, not those of the state or the government for which I labor. My perspective, though, I hope is not law-related in the sense that only pre-law or criminal justice majors might appreciate. I hope that no matter what your chosen major is, that you will gain something from my unique perspectives on life lessons that will benefit you. I've entitled my remarks, A View from the Bench. Now, even though I've only been a judge for 7 years, I have had other experiences in my life viewing things from the bench. As a young man, I enjoyed sports and took part in them to the extent that my physical abilities would allow. But my participation was often relegated to watching and giving encouragement from the bench. The view from that bench is not what I will talk about today. But now, having become a judge, I feel somewhat vindicated because, and I share this thought in all humility, the legal profession is the only game where the best players get to sit on the bench. So the bench I occupy now is certainly different, and my youthful mantra of put me in, coach, I'm ready to play, is now replaced more with thoughts of, isn't there someone here who would like to run with this ball for a while? Being a judge requires living a solitary life. Decision-making is my life's work and purpose, and in that, I am required to act almost always on my own. So my view from the bench is a unique view. I unfortunately witness many things that most would not choose to experience voluntarily. I see the outcroppings of bad decisions, of poor families, and of what some call the underbelly of our society. But I live a life of dichotomy. On the one hand, as you heard, I'm blessed to serve as a bishop in the church. In that capacity, I have the opportunity to see people at their best, good people making good and wise decisions, sacrificing for the common good, and showing their love for our Savior by working to build His kingdom. On the other hand, as a judge for the state of Idaho, I often see people at their worst. People who, on the whole, are not inherently evil, but who, due to life circumstances, their addictions, a lack of resources, or simply the follies and short-sightedness of youth, have made horrendous decisions which have affected their lives in staggering ways. And yet, the dichotomy is not always so stark. In both arenas, there are times when I work as an agent of change, whether that change comes through the spiritual process of repentance or through the court process of finding guilt and sentencing. But for today, I will call upon my role as a state trial judge, commenting on things I have seen that you may never see, offering you insight and direction that I hope will help you better understand what it is to be a judge and the importance of our system of laws. Before I get to the meat of my remarks, let me give you some additional background briefly about what it is that I do. I'm assigned both civil and criminal cases. Civil cases are disputes between individuals, and I oversee those cases when the amount in controversy between the parties is over $10,000. Most civil cases settle without a trial, and while those cases often present interesting facts and circumstances, the life lessons provided there are rare and generally very fact-specific. Criminal law, on the other hand, presents me an opportunity to observe the natural man in action. Life lessons are provided me on a daily basis, and so it is from this perspective that I speak today. The examples I will share are entirely real. I have changed the names for privacy, but the details are accurate. All involve events in people's lives which change them and their families considerably. I will speak about my observations in three areas. First, how decisions determine destiny. Second, the truth embodied in our word of wisdom. And third, the power for positive change in all of us. We in Twin Falls were blessed a little over 2 years ago with the dedication of the Twin Falls Temple. On the weekend of the dedication, President Monson addressed the youth of our temple district during the cultural celebration, reminding them that decisions determine destiny. He taught this earlier at a church education fireside when he said, and I quote, "I can't stress too strongly that decisions determine destiny. You can't make eternal decisions without eternal consequences. May I provide a simple formula by which you can measure the choices which confront you? It's easy to remember, sometimes difficult to apply. You can't be right by doing wrong. You can't be wrong by doing right. Your personal conscience always warns you as a friend before it punishes you as a judge." End of quote. As a trial judge, I'm often confronted with people who try to convince me that I should help them avoid the consequences of their bad choices. Rare is the person who understands the difference between something bad happened and I did something bad. As Ivern Ball has said, most of us can read the writing on the wall, we just assume that it's addressed to someone else. And so, like the stern parent, I am often tasked with confronting people's bad choices and to, with coercion and even punishment as necessary, help them to understand, as our prophet has counseled, that decisions do determine destiny, that people are free to choose their actions but not the consequences that flow from those choices. I would like to share with you the story of a young man that I will call Sam. Sam was born in 1982. He was raised in a good family with good parents who loved him and cared for him. All who knew Sam characterized him as a great young man with wonderful potential. He was described as kind and very respectful. He was very musical. He played the cello and the guitar and obtained the lead role in one high school musical. Unfortunately, sometime in Sam's junior year of high school, he began to struggle with some of his choices. He was attracted to alcohol. He was arrested for possession of marijuana and breaking and entering. Despite his above-average IQ, he withdrew from school in the middle of his senior year and continued to struggle. He moved in with a friend, and 1 year later, he married. He and his wife had two children, but they continued to struggle with substance abuse, including alcoholism, and Sam fought depression. Sam obtained work in the Twin Falls area, but his marital relationship continued to suffer, and he and his wife fought frequently. Ultimately, Sam was charged for a domestic violence felony. Unfortunately, multiple issues were at play in Sam's life, and later that year, Sam made several choices that determined his destiny even more clearly. On a December night in 2006, Sam spent the night drinking and taking drugs. He awoke the next morning and drove to a store to purchase more beer. He entered the store, obtained a 24-pack of beer, and as he approached the clerk, he placed a handgun on the counter with the barrel towards the clerk. Sam then demanded all of the money from the till, which amounted to a little more than $500. And the clerk complied. Sam then fled the scene in his car, and the authorities were notified. Approximately one half hour later, an Idaho State Police trooper was on patrol and noted a car that matched the getaway car from the robbery. The trooper stopped the car and approached from behind. As he did so, Sam opened the driver's side door, didn't even look at the officer, and fired one shot from his handgun, striking the trooper on the left side of the neck. The trooper was not killed, but he was paralyzed and he will never walk again. Sam fled the scene, heading into Nevada at speeds exceeding 100 miles per hour, eventually crashing into the rear of a tractor trailer in Jackpot, Nevada. Remarkably, Sam lived through the collision and returned to Twin Falls to face charges for the robbery and the shooting. He ultimately pled guilty to the robbery, to aggravated battery for shooting the police officer, and to the domestic violence that he had previously committed on his wife. He was ultimately scheduled for sentencing before me. As a judge, there really is nothing quite so difficult as sentencing, particularly in a case like Sam's. The case presented the ultimate conflict. A promising young man gone astray due to alcohol use and poor choices. And the demands of justice that required a strong response for such behavior. During the sentencing, I heard from the officer, from the lawyers, and from Sam's friends and family. I would like to share with you their testimony so that you can get a feel for what this was like for me. This is what the officer said about the effects of the shooting upon him, and I quote from the testimony during the hearing. "It's nearly impossible to put in writing, you know, how this has affected me and my family. I mean, obviously, it's been a life-changing experience, event for both of us. Every part of my life is entirely different. The stuff I love, that I have enjoyed doing in the past, has been taken away from me. As far as my career goes, I loved what I was doing. That was my job. That was my dream job. Not too many people get to live their dream, but I actually did for 4.5 years, and so I'm thankful for that. However, that career has been taken away from me. So, and then lastly, obviously my family, what this has done to my wife, and to my son, and to my parents. My favorite thing to do was get down on the floor and wrestle around with my son. And, you know, just be able to do those things. But I can't do that anymore. I can't get out of the wheelchair, hardly. That's still stuff that I've got to learn how to do. I'm not asking you to do anything outrageous. I do feel he needs to be punished for what he's done to me and to my family, and whatever you feel is appropriate, my family will be satisfied with." Weighed against the officer's observations, here are the remarks of family who love Sam dearly, from his sister. "I just believe that justice needs to be served, but I also think that justice can be tempered with mercy. For someone who has made a really bad mistake, but that deserves to try and make amends in his life. And I think that Sam deserves to try and move on with his life, with his family, because we need him. We love him very much." From his mother, "We love him so much. And it has affected our family. And I hope, Judge Bevin, that you will consider as you do your sentencing. We know the crimes were horrendous. Our family is heartbroken for the trooper and what he has to go through for his wife and his family, but I just plead that you will take into consideration that he has always been a good man. He's always been gentle. He's never even, as a teenager, ever been involved in a fight." Finally, from his father. "Your Honor, of my 5 children, Sam was my shining star. He offered the greatest prospect for success of all of my children. I did my very best to raise them as individuals, to respond to their needs, to encourage them in the successes that they had. I encouraged them by guiding and directing them the best of my ability. I am proud of Sam, but officer, I'm ashamed of what he did that day to you. I will forever be sorry and in your debt. I'm sorry he has devastated your family and your life. When we're finished with these proceedings, we will all go on with our lives. I will be there for the rest of my life for Sam and his family. And I hope that I can endure long enough to see my son a free man so that I might embrace him one more time." And so, perhaps from hearing the actual words of the officer victim and Sam's family, you can contemplate, even in a small way, the complexities that I face in trying to mete out justice. The enormity of Sam's actions cannot be overstated. The officer will never walk again. He'll never wrestle with his son or go hunting or patrol our roadways to keep us safe. Shooting him was a very, very poor decision for Sam to make. On the other hand, Sam is described as a kind, loving son and brother and a father of 2. We can ask, what would possess Sam to make such a poor decision? There are no easy answers. Drugs, alcohol, and Sam's mental state played a part. But no one really knows what was going on inside Sam's head on that fateful day. It is troublesome when generally decent people make horrific choices. But there is no doubt that such decisions and those made along the pathway to the final choice determined Sam's destiny. And not just for Sam, but also for the trooper, his family, and for Sam's family. Sometimes decisions seem so insignificant. We go about doing the things that often in the heat of the moment bring us short-lived pleasure. But my counsel to you and my purpose in sharing Sam's story is to emphasize that Sam, at some point in his life, was not unlike a lot of us. And yet choices were made, choosing alcohol and drugs over school and family. And ultimately, those small choices led to Sam making choices that will cause him to spend the majority of his life behind bars. So the next time you have a so-called minor decision to make, or when friends may try to make those decisions for you, please realize that those decisions have consequences. And sometimes the consequences cannot be fixed in this lifetime. Realize that we must daily strive to do the right thing and live with the benefit of the Spirit so that we do not end up in places of temporal or even spiritual confinement. Many of the poor decisions that I'm required to address through prison, jail, or probation involve the misuse of drugs and alcohol. Anecdotally, I would say that more than 85% of the people I see in court week after week for sentencing, no matter what the nature of their specific felony may be, are addicted to drugs and alcohol. It is remarkable that we Latter-day Saints have had this knowledge since February 1833, when the prophet Joseph Smith received the revelation we know so well as the Word of Wisdom. We are likely very familiar with the do's and don'ts of this law of health. But how many of you are equally aware of the preamble to the revelation that is contained in section 89, verse 4 of the Doctrine and Covenants? There the Lord says, "Behold, verily, thus saith the Lord unto you, in consequence of the evils and designs which do and will exist in the hearts of conspiring men in the last days, I have warned you and forewarn you by giving unto you this word of wisdom by revelation." Thus, because of the evils and designs which do and will exist in the hearts of conspiring men in these days, we have been warned. Conspiring men form what is known legally as a conspiracy. A conspiracy is a combination of persons acting for a secret, unlawful, or evil purpose. We might be more familiar with another term for these organizations, secret combinations. Such secret combinations are nothing new, for we read in Moses that from the days of Cain, there was a secret combination. We learn from 2 Nephi that conspirators' works are works of darkness. And we also understand that these secret combinations are, to quote Nephi again, of the devil, for he is the founder of all these things, yea, the founder of works of darkness. Yea, and he leadeth them by the neck with a flaxen cord until he bindeth them with his strong cords forever. It is compelling evidence to me of the truthfulness of the word of wisdom that even in 1833, we were warned about the dangers brought about by conspiring men and women in the last days. And I can testify that their works of darkness cause individuals, both the knowing abusers and those who might become addicted through thoughtless choices, to be led by the neck with flaxen cords, bound down even unto death. So what of these conspiracies? Could Joseph Smith been aware in 1833 of what the 21st century would look like? Do these conspiracies in reality exist? They absolutely do. And here are a couple of recent media reports about these works of darkness. First, a press release from July 23rd, San Diego, California. A criminal complaint was unsealed today charging 43 defendants with participating in a federal racketeering conspiracy. The conspiracy alleged in the complaint involves the commission of both state and federal crimes, including murder, conspiracy to commit murder, kidnapping, conspiracy to commit kidnapping, robbery, conspiracy to commit robbery, drug trafficking, and money laundering offenses. As set forth in the complaint, the defendants are members and associates of the Fernando Sanchez Organization, an offshoot of the Arellano Felix drug trafficking cartel. Perhaps you have heard of drug cartels. Drug cartels commit murder, robbery, and money laundering, all in secret, and all with the aim of promoting their conspiracies to barter illegal drugs. Here's another press release from Philadelphia. Huang Tri Tron, 39, of Mississauga, Ontario, Canada, was sentenced on August 24th to 70 months in prison for her role in two drug trafficking conspiracies. Tron was the ringleader of an international drug trafficking organization which smuggled millions of ecstasy pills and other drugs from Canada into the United States between 2002 and her arrest in April 2008. The drugs were manufactured in Canada by various Asian organized crime groups and were distributed to drug dealers across the United States. Tron and her associates often smuggled 100,000 ecstasy pills into the United States per week. And lest you think that illegal drugs are the only focus for conspiring men in these days, consider the following report. Tobacco industry documents, now available on the internet, disclose the establishment of a conspiracy between Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds, British American Tobacco, and U.K. tobacco companies dating from 1977. The documents also disclose the objects of the conspiracy. Basically, to protect the industry's commercial interests, both by promoting controversy over smoking and disease, and through strategies directed at reassuring smokers. This conspiracy was the subject of a 6-year lawsuit in our federal courts. The case ended with a 29-week trial and thousands of pages in legal findings by the presiding judge, holding that the alleged conspiracy did in fact exist. What does this mean? It means that it took our government millions of dollars in attorney's fees and over 6 years in litigation to come to the same conclusion stated through revelation to Joseph Smith in 1833. Evil men conspire in the latter days, and tobacco is not for the body, neither for the belly, and is not good for men. And why is it that these warnings were given to us by revelation? Certainly so that we can run and not be weary and walk and not faint, as we're promised, but also, and I believe even more importantly for us in these days, to keep us from being led by the neck until Satan bindeth us with his strong cords forever. I've seen the binding effects of alcohol and drugs on innumerable occasions. It is noteworthy that beyond the way these substances affect one's physical health is the manner that they facilitate Satan's goals of destroying individuals and families. The following is but one example of this reality. In 2004, a woman I will call Janie was 19 years old. The Twin Falls police were called to Janie's apartment to investigate the death of her 9-month-old son, Eric. Janie and her boyfriend, Brandon, had put Eric to bed about 11 o'clock the night before. At approximately 10 a.m. the next morning, Brandon took the baby from his crib and placed the baby in bed with Brandon and Janie. At approximately 2:20 p.m., the adults awoke to find Eric still and not breathing. Brandon told the officers that either he or Janie had rolled on the child while in bed, smothering the baby. During a search of the residence, as part of the investigation, numerous glass pipes and packaging materials for drugs were found. A toxicology report on the baby's death showed that the baby had 22 times the minimum quantifiable amount of methamphetamine in his system. Janie admitted that she and Brandon had smoked methamphetamine in the same room as the baby frequently before his death. When Eric died, both Janie and Brandon had been up for days smoking meth and were just beginning to crash. Janie's addiction to methamphetamine began 3 years before when she was 16. Due to her considerable meth use, she had a hard time recalling details or even showing emotion, even upon the death of her child. After serving time in jail, Janie was ultimately released on probation. She obtained drug treatment and was supervised closely. And thankfully, Janie appears to have beaten her meth habit and moved on. Janie is a real-world exemplar of what drugs and alcohol can do and how they can hold people captive. I've seen methamphetamine-addicted mothers who choose the drug over their children, much like Janie. Other individuals who choose alcohol or other drugs over their freedom, and those who end up dead because of it. Again, Nephi's reference to Satan's flaxen cord is all the more profound. Unfortunately, we in this church are not immune to these effects. Over the past 2 years, while the use of methamphetamine and other illegal drugs has remained steady, I'm witnessing an alarming increase in the numbers of people who are charged with prescription drug abuse. And too many of these offenders are members of our church. This past April, Utah lawmakers responded to what some in that state are calling a crisis in prescription drug abuse, with legislation aimed to curb the threat. In Utah, prescription drug overdoses soared 500% between 1999 and 2007. The Utah Department of Health reported in 2007 that the rate of prescription drug overdose deaths is more than twice that of deaths attributed to the use of street drugs. And more Utahns died of drug overdoses than from car crashes. I cite to these statistics to point out that we all have a need to be warned and forewarned of the dangers lurking behind the misuse of mind-altering substances, whatever the source of those substances may be. Beyond that, we members of the church have the benefit of prophetic warnings that we must heed. There are those, perhaps even some in this small audience, who feel that dabbling in drugs is not a problem just for fun, or that the use of stimulants to help late-night studying or long drives home is okay. It is not okay. Let us heed the warnings of our prophets and our leaders by both avoiding and living without the debilitating effects of addictive substances. Our prophet gave us this counsel in 1833, and it is so much more applicable today. And I strongly appeal for you to follow that counsel. Now, as you have perhaps surmised, given my comments thus far, much of what I deal with on a daily basis is negative. Imposing prison sentences, disciplining lawbreakers, trying to maintain order in people's lives when disorder is the measure of their existence. Most of this work is accomplished using what I have found to be yesterday's logic. Peter Drucker has said that the greatest danger in times of turbulence is not the turbulence itself. It is to act with yesterday's logic. The exponential increase in drug crime and family violence in the last 2 decades have caused turbulence for the courts. And the courts are now giving up yesterday's logic for what is hopefully a better result. Over time, we in the courts have come to recognize that there are better, smarter ways to deal with societal challenges, such as drug abuse, mentally disabled defendants, domestic violence, and family instability. These better ways have evolved into what are now known as problem-solving courts. Courts are also called drug courts or family courts. Problem-solving courts have been created not to simply put a Band-Aid on these societal problems, but to provide better solutions to these challenges by working outside the proverbial box of adversary proceedings and beyond the literal box of a jail cell. I preside over a problem-solving court, the 5th Judicial District Mental Health Court. This court and others like it concentrates on offenders with specialized needs, whether those needs are addiction-related, family problems, or mental illness. Problem-solving courts represent a fundamental departure from old ways of judging by using non-adversarial, remedial approaches to treating these unique cases. Let me note that not every offender qualifies for placement in a problem-solving court. Individuals must meet certain criteria, and those with a history of criminality or who are charged with extreme violence or sexual crimes do not qualify. But for those who do qualify, problem-solving courts can make a world of difference. These courts are unique in that while a judge presides in the courtroom, the court is actually staffed and run by a team of individuals, including treatment providers, vocational rehabilitation experts, probation officers, coordinators, and attorneys. Our team in Twin Falls even includes a former criminal defendant who graduated from our program and has now done so well that he is employed as a peer specialist, helping defendants in the court understand and navigate through the court system. The team uses a collaborative approach and close supervision to help individuals move through a series of four phases, from more restrictive to more relaxed supervision. Our goal is that the individual graduate from the court, free from addiction, with a job and their family intact. This model is working wonders. Throughout Idaho and our nation, hundreds of defendants graduate yearly, and very few of them return to a life of crime. In Twin Falls, only one of our mental health court graduates has picked up a new felony since graduation. Nationally, statistics show that more than 2 out of 3 of these inmates released are rearrested. And when I say these inmates, I mean inmates without this type of strict and direct intervention. Inmates released from jail or prison are rearrested within 3 years. That's 2/3. However, only 19% of Idaho's drug court graduates have a new arrest in that same time frame. Thus, if the benefit of this approach to justice is viewed simply from a taxpayer benefit standpoint, the courts work. People are staying out of jail and out-of-state mental hospitals because of the participants' engagement in the process of real change. Beyond that, these courts work from a societal standpoint. It is impossible to truly measure the costs of family breakdown, increased victimization, and general community ill will that we suffer when individuals engage in the ongoing cycle of criminality. Without new and innovative approaches, many of these people would simply serve life sentences on the installment plan, while our communities are faced with the ongoing damage from their behaviors. I would like to share with you a letter from one of our earliest mental health court graduates. The letter shows the transformation that takes place in people when they engage in a problem-solving court. She wrote about her experiences in her own words as follows. I've been in the mental health court program since the very beginning. I was the first participant to be in this program today I graduate. Before this program, my behavior was erratic. Today, looking back, I am completely different. I will always be Sonia, but a much better version. Shortly before the program, I was Magic Valley's most wanted. I had originally been picked up for public intoxication and destroying evidence. I thought I could get away with it. Dishonesty wastes time. That's something I've learned in this program, taking responsibility for what I've done, dealing with the consequences. It isn't easy at first doing what's right, but if you practice doing what's right for a long period of time, it becomes a way of life. Honesty is a tool, and it works much like magic. Integrity, honor, self-respect, and dignity. Talking more about the struggle I had in the past, I've slept on sidewalks, slept in parks. Living the life I did was a scary place. Running around mentally ill is entirely unpredictable and completely fearful. This program has been a positive experience. Today I graduate from the District 5 Mental Health Court program. I have over 2.5 years of sobriety. I have a daughter. She is the first drug-free baby to be born in the District 5 Mental Health Court program. She and I set a significant landmark in the program. I also acquired my GED during participation, and I graduated every class. This program was a life-changing experience for me. The personal benefits have been huge. I am a better person today with a better, happier life. I now have plans and goals and visions of an awesome future. That letter was written over 2 years ago and is but one example of the power for positive change that the courts are having by adopting new and innovative methods. Sonia's experience is not unique. Hers is but an example of the power that individuals do have to change. I'm grateful that as a trial judge, I get to witness these changes week by week as participants come to the court, share their thoughts, engage in treatment, counseling, and workforce training, and transform into productive citizens. Some decry these efforts to rehabilitate those convicted of crime as too soft, but remember that the most serious or violent offenders do not qualify. And yet, even some judges have trouble squaring the concept of a judge as disciplinarian with the judge, who is a cheerleader of sorts, giving congratulations and commendation when due, scolding at times, and working to truly be an agent of change for others. But given the positive outcomes that we are seeing nationwide, even these judges' thoughts are beginning to change. As a Latter-day Saint judge, this part of my job is the most rewarding. As a member of his church, I recognize that the Savior of the world served the poor and the weary. He never placed himself above those who needed him and his love. He was, for them, the source of hope. On a much smaller scale, but certainly with the same motivation, problem-solving courts also offer hope. And offering hope, even in the secular realm of a courtroom, is a very promising endeavor. People can and do change, and much like the woman taken in sin in Jesus' day, they can go their ways and sin no more, even if only from a mortal perspective. I would like to conclude with a few thoughts about our obligations to be good citizens. We Latter-day Saints, beyond simply honoring, obeying, and sustaining the law, believe that governments were instituted of God for the benefit of man. And in quoting from section 134, we will be held accountable for our acts in relation to them, both in making and administering laws for the good and safety of society. Tomorrow is Constitution Day. On September 17, 1787, the U.S. Constitution was signed by 39 brave men who changed the course of history. Now, Constitution Day affords us an opportunity to continue that legacy and develop habits of good citizenship. I would encourage you to become aware of what activities are going to be held here on campus tomorrow and engage in them. Elder Dallin H. Oaks spoke on this campus in October 2009 about religious freedom. It is not mere coincidence that he spoke here because his remarks were directed largely at your generation. He noted that we are all engaged in a battle over the meaning of religious freedom, and the contest is of eternal importance. Quoting from him, "It is your generation that must understand the issues and make the efforts to prevail." End of quote. Thus, your generation is tasked with not just honoring and obeying the law, but, as we commit in the 12th article of faith, with sustaining the law. How does a Latter-day Saint citizen sustain the law? Elder Sterling W. Sill taught us about the importance of sustaining our laws nearly 40 years ago, and I would quote from him. He said, "We have a direct revelation from the Lord that he raised up wise men to establish the constitution of this land, and he requires that it be maintained for the protection of all flesh, according to just and holy principles, that everyone may act according to his God-given moral agency. It is a divine decree that this land should serve as the citadel of liberty, and it is the American mission to help freedom, righteousness, and human dignity, help keep freedom, righteousness, and human dignity alive in the world." If it is indeed the American mission to keep freedom alive in the world, and I believe that it is, then we each have an obligation to do our part as good citizens. Margaret Mead has said, quote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, concerned citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has," end of quote. Thus, it is incumbent upon your generation to be mindful of this significant call upon your instinctive talents and abilities. You must be actively engaged. Know what is going on in your communities and do your part to engage in government. Remember, as we read in section 134, that we will be held accountable for our actions in relation to our governments. We live in a troubled world, one where Satan's works of darkness continue, not just in drug-related cartels, drug-related conspiracies, but in multiple ways in various settings. The counterbalance of darkness has always been light, and it is you who must carry that light into your communities and our nation. I encourage you, no matter your chosen major, to learn about our Constitution, study our laws, and stand ready to defend them and the principles of truth which our prophets and leaders continue to teach. Make a difference by being the kind of citizen who knows what it means to stand for truth and for right, and to stand as witnesses at all times in proper ways. To quote again from Elder Sill, who uses the metaphor of battle to describe our duty, quote, "When we sing, 'God Bless America,' What kind of an America should we have in mind? Certainly not a drunken America, nor a criminal America, nor an irresponsible America. We must not build an atheistic America, nor a disloyal America, nor a weak America, nor an immoral America. And to effectively serve God and our country, every good church member and every good citizen should be constantly waging war. Not a war against anybody, but a war for everybody. A war for God and for freedom and for truth and for righteousness and for success. This is precisely the admonition I would give you in closing today. You are indeed the chosen generation, those who bear or support the royal priesthood. It is you who can, while watching in all perseverance, wage the war for God and for liberty. I so appreciate the time we have shared this afternoon. My view from the bench is a unique one. The secular world is alive and well, and sometimes in our own circumstances, we fail to realize the power we have to make a difference. May you make decisions that will determine the destiny you want. May you be alert of the evils of conspiring men in these latter days, having the courage to stand for truth and righteousness. And may you be aware of each of our abilities to act as agents of change for ourselves, our families, and our communities, is my prayer. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.